Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today we've got news about a new task force to help the homeless in East County. We'll also have details on some of Donald Trump's latest cabinet appointees. Then hear how some Syrian refugees spent their first Thanksgiving in East County. We have some good news about a new program that's saving lives by allowing sheriff's deputies to administer antidotes for drug overdoses. Then on Tribal Beat, we'll have the latest on an eviction notice issued to the Standing Rock Sioux and reinforcements from veterans around the nation who are coming to protect the water protectors. On Destination East County, hear about all the holiday happenings and other events across our region. Learn about some hikers rescued after a chilling night out in a Tehesa Canyon. Next, learn about the Toys for Tots drive and how you can help brighten the holidays for local children in need. And finally, in honor of Pearl Harbor Day coming up this week, we'll be re-airing our interview with Dr. Kenneth Hansen, who was there when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and will share his dramatic memories of those historic times. We'll have all these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
The newly created San Diego East County Regional Homeless Task Force held its first meeting in mid-November at the El Cajon Police Department. The effort is being led by the San Diego East County Chamber of Commerce with support from our civic leaders, educators, law enforcement, social service providers, religious, and other nonprofit organizations. About 100 people attended the inaugural meeting, including city managers from La Mesa, El Cajon, and Lemon Grove. The group seeks a collaborative effort to address homelessness problems, which are beyond what any single community can resolve, as the number of homeless has grown countywide. Eric Lund, CEO and president of the East County Chamber, says, "We need to bring everybody together so people understand how homelessness is impacting all these different sectors of our community," the San Diego Union-Tribune reports. Last year, a county grand jury report encouraged the cities of La Mesa, El Cajon, Lemon Grove, and Santee to coordinate efforts to increase prevention, shelter, and transitional housing needs for the homeless in East County. Too often, homeless sweeps by law enforcement in one city or unincorporated community have simply pushed the homeless onto streets of neighboring towns without giving homeless people the help they need. Participants voiced compassion for helping the homeless, but also cited concerns raised by residents and business owners. The city of San Diego has drawn national criticism for its callous treatment of the homeless, such as installing sharp rocks to discourage homeless people from taking shelter beneath an overpass on rainy nights. The rocks were installed shortly before the All-Star game to clean up the city's image for visiting baseball fans, but drew scornful comments on social media. Many homeless have also had their belongings seized or been cited for trespass on public property, even when no shelters were available. A Union Tribune reporter this week reported on one homeless woman found about to give birth in a rat-infested tent. Law enforcement groups last year formed the East County Homeless Outreach Team, a collaboration of sheriffs, deputies, and other local law enforcement representatives, as well as county social workers. Now, the larger East County Homeless Task Force aims to go further and create a regional plan to address the needs of homeless people and communities. The group plans its next meeting in January, when it will hold breakout sessions on specific topics impacting homelessness in our region. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is John Fistier.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery, and I'm here with Jonathan Goetz for today's East County Magazine Capitol Report. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Miriam.
Now, President-elect Donald Trump ran as an outsider, a reality TV celebrity and business mogul with no political experience who has pledged to shake up the status quo in Washington, D.C. And so far, his cabinet appointees reflect a mix of people who are outside that D.C. beltway, as well as some seasoned Washington insiders. But in reaching outside the halls of power to fill some of those key posts, Trump is drawing praise from some supporters, but he's also raising a lot of concern among critics for choosing appointees who lack experience in relative fields. Other appointees with relevant qualifications, however, have drawn criticisms precisely because of their past actions, financial ties, or temperament. So, Jonathan, you've been researching his appointee for United Nations Ambassador. What can you tell us about South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley?
Yes. Haley is slated to become United Nations ambassador, though she has no foreign policy experience other than traveling abroad as governor to promote investment in the state. Haley has shown backbone in calling for removal of Confederate flags after a massacre at a black church in her state, and she holds conservative pro-life and pro-business views. As an Indian American, she does add diversity to the Trump cabinet, but if confirmed, she may be the least experienced individual to hold the post.
Interesting.
Miriam, what about the education secretary?
That would be Betsy DeVos, and she has never worked in public education at all. In fact, she's never taught school, nor has she had any children who attended public schools. She is a major donor to the Trump campaign, however, and she has headed conservative groups that are focused on education reforms. Those include vouchers and charter schools that actually draw money out of the public school system to allow people to go wherever they want, send their kids to private schools or charters and so forth. She is an heiress to the Amway fortune, and she and her husband also had a foundation that has led efforts to oppose gay marriage. Plus, she's a staunch creationist, and that's fueled some concerns over separation of church and state in public schools. There could be a battle for confirmation in the Senate on this one. Jonathan, what can you tell us about Donald Trump's preferred choice to head up the Department of Housing and Urban Development? This is a name that some of you may be familiar with.
Oh, yes, yes. Dr. Ben Carson, Trump's opponent during the primary. Carson is Trump's preferred choice to lead the Department of Housing and Urban Development, though he has zero experience in the HUD housing issues. Potentially, Carson or others lacking experience could make up for it by choosing experienced staff, but they would not be hitting the ground running.
Yeah, definitely. Now, so far we've talked about the appointees who really lacked the relevant experience in their fields for the most part. Other nominees of his and appointees unquestionably at least have experience in the field, although they're not controversy-free, certainly. What can you tell us about retired Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, who would be Trump's choice for a national security advisor, which, by the way, does not require Senate confirmation?
Retired Lieutenant General Mike Flynn formerly served as director of the Defense Intelligence Agency for 2 years during the Obama administration, but was fired for what one Pentagon official described as a disruptive management style that included shouting at others. Trump also tapped Fox News analyst Kathleen Troia, KT McFarland, to serve as deputy national security advisor. She served in various posts under former presidents Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, another that's a very controversial choice is his pick as director of the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA. That would be Representative Mike Pompeo, who does serve on the House Intelligence Committee. He is a military veteran who graduated first in his class from West Point, got his law degree from Harvard, where he served on the law review, so he's unquestionably very bright. Even his critics contend that he's also hardworking. However, he's been viewed by many as overtly partisan after his relentless investigations into the Benghazi allegations involving Hillary Clinton, which of course were found to be baseless by these various committees that investigated. And he's drawn sharp criticisms from civil liberties and human rights groups because of his support for things like broad surveillance powers and controversial interrogation techniques that have actually been banned under international law. Jonathan,
Why don't you talk about another one of his controversial choices, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions?
Oh, yes, and you wrote a great article on that. Trump's pick as attorney general once helped prosecute Ku Klux Klan members for murder as a U.S. attorney in Alabama, but later failed to win Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation for a federal judicial position due to allegations that he had made racial remarks and opposed the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah.
Now, tell us about Breitbart.
Oh, boy. Well, I think arguably the most controversial appointee of all of them so far has been Steve Bannon. This is Trump's pick as the White House chief of staff. It does not require any confirmation. Bannon took over as the publisher of Breitbart Media, which started out as a conservative news site, and under his leadership, he morphed it into what he himself has called a mouthpiece for the alt-right. And the alt-right is a movement that truly has its roots in racism and anti-Semitism. In fact, the founder of the alt-right movement was photographed celebrating Trump's victory with Nazi salutes at a New York restaurant. Make no mistake, that is what the alt-right movement is all about. Very, very troubling to an awful lot of people in America.
And the Koch brothers got their money out of this. Energy lobbyist Mike McKenna has been named to head Trump's Department of Energy transition team. His recent clients include Dow Chemical and the oil tycoon Koch brothers, Climate Wire and Scientific American Report.
Yeah. He's definitely no friend to the environmental movement. Of course, he ran on a platform of wanting to undo the Paris Climate Accord, says he doesn't believe in climate change. And now Trump has named an infamous climate denier, Myron Ebel, to lead the Environmental Protection Agency's transition team. Ebel has said that climate change is nothing to worry about in an interview with Vanity Fair. And that, of course, is leading to fears that Trump will live up to that campaign pledge to withdraw the U.S. from the World Climate Agreement forged in Paris, as well as increasing coal and oil-fired power plant production and things like controversial oil pipelines. Now, another of his campaign promises was to repeal and replace Obamacare, or maybe just repeal it altogether. What can you tell us about Trump's choice to head up Health and Human Services, which would be overseeing all of that?
Republican Congressman Tom Price, a vocal opponent of Obamacare, who has also pledged to dismantle Medicare, is Trump's pick to head up the Department of Health and Human Services.
Yeah, that dismantling of Medicare may come as a surprise to some of his voters. I read somewhere that something like 5 million Trump voters may be losing health care or Medicare under this guy's leadership. Now, another Washington insider that he picked is Elaine Chao as transportation secretary. She has actually served in both Republican and Democratic administrations, so she does have a lot of experience. Of course, Trump's talking about these infrastructure projects, so the transportation secretary could be an important and powerful position. Her husband, very partisan, is the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who incidentally has said that he will not recuse himself from voting on his wife's nomination. Talk about nepotism.
Well, Trump's latest appointments add to the perception that he is loading up his cabinet with corporate cronies. I mean, this week he announced former Goldman Sachs banker Steven Mnuchin as Secretary of Treasury nominee, a billionaire hedge fund manager who critics say preyed on homeowners during the recession.
That's kind of maybe not surprising to some, but he did on the campaign trail. He was at times kind of echoing Bernie Sanders a little bit about talking about the powers of Wall Street. And here he's turned around and appointed the ultimate Wall Street insider, arguably, to head up the Treasury Department. Now, he also named Wilbur Ross, who's a billionaire businessman, to serve as Commerce Department secretary. And, of course, this would be the person who would be overseeing things like any changes that may happen in trade deals, trade pacts, among other things. Trump, of course, is getting reactions on both sides of the aisle on this. Jonathan, can you give us an example of why some people are supportive of these appointees overall?
Well, former Georgia Senator Saxe Chambliss, now working with the lobbying and law firm DLA Piper, told CNN that Trump has picked people who can get things done by choosing people that know how the system works and are willing to make the commitment to him and his policies.
Yeah, so it seems like he's rewarding loyalists, people who supported him on the campaign trail, gave him money, that sort of thing. But instead of draining the swamp in D.C. like he promised, it seems like he's been pulling an awful lot of people out of that swamp to help him out, at least in the transition. On the other side of the coin, Democratic National Committee spokesman Adam Hodge has reacted to these nominations by calling Donald Trump, quote, the most corrupt, conflicted, and unpopular president-elect in history who has broken his campaign promise as an outsider to drain the swamp and break the stranglehold of lobbyists and special interests in the nation's capital. That's been our Capitol Report. Jonathan, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The youngest survivors of Syria's civil war are a traumatized generation. In the past year, 10,000 Syrian refugees have been admitted into the U.S., and 80% of those are children. Nearly all have suffered severe trauma. San Diego County has taken in 676 Syrian refugees, more than any other county in America, and many of those have settled in East County. On Thanksgiving Day, local residents welcomed the newcomers with gifts and turkey dinners, generating gratitude among refugees moved by this kindness. One refugee woman told 10 News, "We love you, American people, for allowing us to come to the safety of the United States." She spoke through a translator at a Thanksgiving event in El Cajon, where smiles showed the joy on the faces of Syrian children. These families are among 100 refugees who have found temporary safety at a motel in El Cajon after coming straight from war-torn Syria. They are among the lucky ones. According to Business Insider, 80% of Syria's children, 8.4 million tiny victims, have been harmed by the war. At one refugee camp, 79% of the children had lost their parents. Humanitarian aid is desperately needed to save 6 million children who are still left in Syria, where 4,500 children have died in Aleppo airstrikes. Some of them have witnessed torture, or been tortured themselves. According to Dalia Mohammed, a volunteer with License for Freedom helping out at that Thanksgiving Day celebration in El Cajon, she says she is happy to give back this Thanksgiving after coming here herself as a refugee a decade ago. Elsewhere in San Diego, Heart for Refugees, a branch of the Syrian Community Network, raised funds to provide Thanksgiving turkeys and more for Syrian refugee families. Local San Diegans delivered the feasts, meeting directly with refugees. Meanwhile, Mike Glantz, chief executive officer of Hire a Helper, sent a bus to bring Syrian families to his office in Oceanside for a Thanksgiving dinner to do our little part to helping bring them into our culture and welcome them, he told KPBS. That kind gesture meant a lot to Yahya Assad, who endured torture and detention after his home in Syria was shelled. The family fled to Jordan, but was never invited to anyone's home and did not feel welcomed there, he said. Before, I felt like there was no dignity, he reflects, adding, now I feel like I have some value as a human being. The first Syrian war refugee resettled in the U.S. was Nadim Fazi Juria, who came to El Cajon earlier this year with his wife and four children, ages 8 to 14. He calls America a beautiful country because of its treatment of newcomers. When you go down the streets, everyone smiles at you, he says, Associated Press reports. Whether future refugees from Syria will have such hope or not is dependent upon President-elect Donald Trump, who has called President Barack Obama's promise to accept 65,000 Syrian refugees a great Trojan horse. He has pledged to halt admission of Syrian refugees, though thus far not a single refugee from Syria has been tied to any terror threats. Refugee relocation is determined by where refugees have families. If they don't have relatives in the U.S., then they are sent to cities with established immigrant communities that share their culture. El Cajon has become a haven, first for Iraqi Chaldean Christians and later other Middle Eastern refugees, including Muslims. Many teachers, shopkeepers, and others here speak Arabic. Police reach out to help refugees understand the laws. Churches, mosques, and nonprofit organizations all work to help the new refugees. During the first week of school in El Cajon this year, 76 Syrian children were enrolled. The Cajon Valley Union School District offers one-on-one orientations to introduce families to teachers and staff, also offering newcomer classes for refugees and counselors to help students who have endured trauma. Eyal Bergman, a family and community engagement officer at the district, says many children have seen terrible things, but I also see incredible resilience, she told Fox News. For Joya and his family, the future is now one of hope, not despair. Here in America, his family has set new goals. We hope our children succeed in education and will be able to have a good future here, he concludes. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
The County of San Diego reports an experimental program that allows sheriff's deputies to administer antidotes to people suffering from opioid overdoses is saving lives. Since 2014, the county indicates that 37 people have been saved due to deputies providing the life-saving drug to people overdosing on opioids, such as heroin, morphine, or oxycodone. The Sheriff's Department is the only law enforcement agency in the county that carries the antidote, but other local police are considering carrying it in the near future, says Captain Todd Richardson. Last year, 90 people died of heroin overdoses, and in 2014, heroin killed 105 people locally, according to the medical examiner's office. A person overdosing on opioids will stop breathing without intervention. They become pale and cold, their lips or nails may turn blue, and they may be unable to speak or awaken. If these symptoms occur, they need immediate medical attention. A quick dose of an opioid inhibitor such as naloxone immediately allows the person to breathe on their own. Every year, sheriff's deputies are the first to arrive on the scene, ahead of paramedics or firefighters, in approximately 150 overdose cases. In July of 2014, the San Diego County Sheriff's Department began a six-month pilot program to train deputies from an East County station to carry and administer the life-saving nasal spray drug. 14 of the 15 people who received the antidote survived. The program's high success rate resulted in the Sheriff's Department expanding the program. In nearly 2 years since, it has been used another 29 times, saving 23 patients. The drug is currently carried by all sheriff's patrol units, plus units, courts, and schools. For deputies to have a chance at saving a life, someone has to call 911 to report the medical emergency, and they need to begin CPR if the person has stopped breathing. But often, a person with the patient who is overdosing may also be under the influence of drugs and afraid to call for help for fear of being arrested. But a Good Samaritan law passed in 2012 says that if you're calling for help for an overdose for yourself or anyone else, you can't be arrested for being under the influence of an illegal narcotic or possessing the narcotic. There are exceptions. If the caller is selling narcotics, administered the drug without the person's consent, was driving under the influence, or violated their probation or parole. The county funds drug prevention and treatment services throughout the region. Treatment is available by calling the county's Access and Crisis Line at 888-724-7240. One more time, that's the county's Access and Crisis Line at 888-724-7240. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Lynn Powell Macklin.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's Tribal Beat. Bitter cold and heavy snow have descended at the Standing Rock Sioux encampment in Cannonball, South Dakota, where Native American activists opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline have been building winter shelters. They are on historical treaty land that the Supreme Court has said was wrongly seized by the U.S. government. They are taking a stand against the oil pipeline that was rerouted away from Bismarck after residents there objected to the threat it would pose to drinking water. The tribes want the same right to clean drinking water that their white neighbors in Bismarck have been granted, and they fear that a pipeline burst could contaminate the Missouri River and other waterways. But on Friday, the U.S. Corps of Army Engineers Colonel John Henderson issued an eviction order requiring that all of the water protectors, as they call themselves, in the main camp north of the Cannonball River evacuate by December 5th, just one day before a coalition of 2,000 military veterans led by Wesley Clark Jr., son of the former Supreme Commander of U.S. Allied Forces in Europe, are set to arrive to stand with the water protectors. Some veterans have posted that in response they are moving up their expected arrival period. Colonel Henderson's written notice states that he is closing the public land managed by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe due to concerns for public safety. A free speech zone will be set up south of the river, far away from sacred lands and pipeline construction that's been slowed for months by thousands of activists, including representatives from over 100 tribes nationwide. But to date, the biggest threat to safety has come not from the protesters, but from the brutal treatment of them by militarized law enforcement forces, including spraying a water cannon at activists in freezing temperatures, shooting tear gas canisters, rubber bullets, and a sound cannon, among other weapons.
Hundreds have been injured and dozens hospitalized. One young woman may lose her arm and another an eye. The activists and witnesses say that they have remained peaceful, as many videos posted online seem to document. Police claim that fires and propane tanks are weapons, but the tribal members say these are simply used to keep warm in winter weather. Now, South Dakota's Governor Jack Dalrymple says no forcible evictions will be made by the state in a statement he issued Saturday, but he's asked the federal government to provide law enforcement resources to enforce the order to vacate the land. Those who remain beyond December 5th will be considered trespassers staying at their own risk, Colonel Henderson warns. South Dakota's two senators, one Republican and one Democrat, also want to see the protesters moved off the land. But several other members of Congress have called for investigations of police brutality by the U.S. Justice Department. And they have urged the Obama administration to intervene and halt or reroute the pipeline, as well as protect the rights of the tribal members and thousands of other people who have come to Standing Rock to support the water defenders. The U.S. Civil Rights Commission has issued a statement denouncing excessive use of force by police at the site, noting that Native Americans are more apt to be killed by police than any other racial group. The commission also called for environmental justice for the tribe, calling for federal, state, and local officials and law enforcement to work together to de-escalate the situation and guarantee the safety of protesters to exercise their First Amendment rights. Civil Rights Commission Chair Martin Castro adds that the issue isn't just the pipeline, but rather, quote, it is about the entire relationship between the United States and sovereign Indian nations, their rights, traditions, and religious beliefs, unquote. President Obama has thus far disappointed many by failing to take action to halt the pipeline construction or protect these water protectors, but waiting for Donald Trump to take office seems an even bleaker option, since Trump owns stock in the company that owns the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the owner of that pipeline has donated $100,000 to help elect Trump to the presidency. He's even boasted to media that he is confident Trump will allow the pipeline construction to be completed. Bobby Wallace from Barona here in San Diego County has led caravans of relief supplies to Standing Rock. On Facebook, he posted gratitude to all who have donated supplies, money, and prayers, adding that it gives strength and hope to our brothers and sisters. And, he says, you saw the abuse, felt the pain, but also felt the power of the good. On Tuesday night, demonstrators marched through the streets of San Diego here in support of the Standing Rock people, and more demonstrations are planned locally. Standing Rock Sioux tribal leader Dave Archambault is adamant that the tribe won't back down. In a letter to Colonel Henderson at the Army Corps of Engineers, he wrote, "This decision, coming on the heels of the Thanksgiving holiday, is not only disrespectful, but continues the cycle of racism and oppression on our people and our lands throughout history. We ask that the Corps of Engineers reconsider this decision." Archambault accuses Colonel Henderson of an irresponsible threat that could further empower the militarized police force that has been, quote, brutalizing and terrorizing our water protectors while imposing the blame and risk on unarmed people. Their plight has drawn attention around the world, in global media, with supporters coming from as far away as New Zealand to stand up for the Standing Rock Sioux. The Standing Rock Sioux tribal leader made clear that he will not seek to end the protests. I recognize and respect their rights under the Constitution of the United States to peaceably assemble in prayerful protest against the cultural and environmental atrocity that is the Dakota Access Pipeline, he concludes. I would not use my authority, which is based on the consent of my citizens, to curtail their human and constitutional rights.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week. This week's Destination East County includes a parade of lights and snow festival, a murder mystery theater, a pottery studios tour, a holiday concert by the San Diego Festival Chorus and Orchestra, and a Christmas festival at Lions, Tigers, and Bears.
Plus, we'll tell you about coming attractions, including La Mesa's Holiday in the Village celebration, a holiday wine trail in Ramona, Victorian Christmas teas, and a production of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol in Julian.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more. Grossmont College's Stage House Theater will present These Shining Lives from December 1st through the 10th. The play recounts the true story of women workers exposed to radiation at the Radium Dial Company. Their fight for justice and their sacrifices created a legacy of better working conditions for future generations. For tickets, check the show's website at grossmont.edu/theaterbrochure.
A twinkling holiday parade, sledding down Snow Hill, visits with Santa, craft booths, and more are all part of the 21st annual Alpine Village Christmas Parade of Lights and Snow Festival on Friday, December 2nd. The parade begins at 6:30 p.m. at West Victoria Boulevard and ends at Alpine Creek Town Center. There, a festival includes real snow to delight youngsters, as well as a kids' zone, foods, vendor booths, and photo opportunities with Santa. For directions or details, you can visit alpinecreekcenter.com.
The City of Lemon Grove will light up the night at its 19th annual community bonfire on Friday, December 2nd at Civic Center Park from 5 to 9 p.m. The city's winter tradition includes the lighting of a giant bonfire, as well as live music, rock climbing, a hayride, game truck, game booths, arts and crafts, face painting, hot chocolate, and snacks. For more information, you can visit lemongrove.ca.gov/.
The pop rock musical Jesus Christ Superstar will be presented at San Diego State University's Don Powell Theater on December 1st through 4th. This explosive psychedelic concert with music by Andrew Lloyd Webber tells a universally known biblical story through the unusual perspective of Judas Iscariot, combining theater, dance, choral, and orchestra departments at SDSU. For tickets, visit the SDSU Theater Department at sdsu.edu.
Pickwick Players will present a murder mystery musical, Something's Afoot, performing off-Broadway live December 2nd through the 7th in Santee. In Something's Afoot, 10 people are stranded in an isolated English country house during a raging thunderstorm. One by one, they're picked off as survivors frantically race to uncover the identity and motivation of a cunning culprit. This zany, entertaining musical takes a satirical poke at Agatha Christie mysteries and musical styles of English music halls in the 1930s. For a full show schedule and tickets, visit pickwickplayers.net.
For a wild holiday event, you're invited to join Lions, Tigers, and Bears, San Diego's only big cat and exotic animal rescue, for a Christmas fundraiser on Saturday, December 3rd from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. You can do some holiday shopping, watch furry friends open Christmas presents, visit with Santa, and enjoy lunch from food trucks. For tickets and details, see lionstigersandbears.org.
You're invited to a holiday open ranch at Alpacas of Diego, located in Descanso, just east of Alpine. This festive day of fun will be held on Saturday, December 3rd, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. You can meet the alpacas, stock up on yarn, fleece, and handmade alpaca gifts for the holidays. Find special activities for children and learn about alpaca farming. For more information, you can visit alpacasofsandiego.com.
On Saturday, December 3rd, the ACES Foundation will be hosting the 6th annual Jingle Paws 1K and 5K Fun Walk from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College. Registration starts at 8 a.m. The ACES Foundation's mission is to support the El Cajon Animal Shelter. They have helped over 20 animals become adoptable by paying for surgeries and other procedures this year. Jingle Paws will also have a Santa's Village after the walk with doggy goodies and pet food vendors. Pictures with Santa. Santa's Adoption Village will have local rescue organizations and adoptable pets. Plus, shots for pets will be available for vaccines. To register or get more information, visit acesfoundation.org.
You can take the kids to breakfast with Santa Claus at the Lakeside Community Center on Saturday, December 3rd from 8 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. Lakeside firefighters and sheriff deputies will be serving up the community breakfast. In addition to meeting Santa, children can enjoy other activities at this festive community event.
The Lakeside Chamber of Commerce invites you to enjoy the spirit of Christmas on Main Avenue in downtown Lakeside on Saturday, December 3rd from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. Santa and his elves are hard at work getting ready for Christmas at this annual event. There will be an atmosphere of an old-fashioned hometown Christmas. This event features all the sights and sounds of Christmas, including local school performances, Santa Claus, food and drinks, kids' activities, jumps, rides, booths, crafters, and lighting the community Christmas tree.
The El Cajon Valley Gem and Mineral Society invites you to their Gem and Mineral Roundup on Saturday, December 3rd from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., on Sunday, December 4th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Lakeside Rodeo Grounds. Enjoy gem, mineral, fossil, jewelry, and craft vendors. There will also be activities for kids as well as gem identification services and unique gifts for holiday shoppers.
The San Diego Pottery Tour on December 3rd and 4th will feature a self-guided tour of 9 studios in San Diego and East County. The tour features ceramic works of our region's top potters. For more information and a tour map, visit sdpotterytour.com.
The San Diego Festival Chorus and Orchestra will present a 15th anniversary holiday concert on Sunday, December 4th from 3 to 5 p.m. at the College Avenue Baptist Church. The classical part of the program will present 2 works, Mozart's Te Deum and
Saint-Saëns'
Christmas Oratorio. The second part of the program will feature seasonal music, including both familiar Christmas carols and some surprises. You will recognize Christmas music in delightful new arrangements and enjoy some unique songs like Going to Bethlehem and No Time to Diet. For tickets, you can visit sandiegofestivalchorus.org.
The last La Mesa Boulevard Stroll of the Year will be held along La Mesa Boulevard on December 7th from 5 to 8 p.m. Santa will be at the Kids Corner from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Enjoy music and entertainment, caroling along the boulevard, and vote for the most festive storefront displays. For more information, visit lamesaboulevardstroll.com.
Julian Tea and Cottage Arts and Julian will host its 22nd annual Victorian Christmas Teas daily from Thursday, December 8th through Friday, December 23rd. This special menu includes a variety of finger sandwiches, savories, tea bread, scone with curd, jam and whipped cream, and a selection of seasonal desserts. Or there is a special children's menu for children under 12. Reservations are required. For more information, visit julientea.com.
The Julian Theater Company will present Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol at the Julian Town Hall on 2 weekends in December, December 9th through 11th, and again December 15th through 17th. This classic holiday tale reveals the transformation of Ebenezer Scrooge, who discovers the holiday spirit after visits by the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future. For tickets and more information, visit JulianTheaterCompany.com.
The La Mesa Village Association's new event, Holiday in the Village, will be held on December 10th from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. You can stroll through La Mesa's historic downtown village and enjoy live music and dance, caroling, fire pits, craft vendors, kids' movies, and activities. For more information, visit lamesavillageassociation.org.
The Ramona Valley Vineyard Association will be holding a holiday wine trail in the heart of East County's wine country on Saturday and Sunday, December 10th and 11th. Wine lovers can visit 16 wineries decked out for the holidays. To reserve your holiday wine trail passport, you can visit RamonaValleyVineyards.com.
The largest outdoor ice skating rink in Southern California is open at Viejas from now through the holiday season until January 29th. Under the glow of holiday lights, guests and visitors can glide around the rink or enjoy seasonal goodies. Feel the cool Pacific mountain air on your face while you bunny hop, camel spin, and twizzle your way around our ice rink right here in San Diego. For details, you can visit www.viejas.com.
That's all for this week.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
Three hikers were stranded overnight Saturday in Sloan Canyon near Dehesa after one fell and injured his head. A rescue helicopter was unable to fly due to stormy weather. Drenched by the deluge in chilly temperatures, the hikers were rescued the next morning by a sheriff's search and rescue team. Rescuers used ropes and pulleys to bring the three hikers to safety. All were in good condition and declined medical treatment, 10 News reports. The incident serves as a reminder to hikers of the importance to be prepared for an emergency by carrying a cell phone, GPS device to pinpoint your location for rescuers, warm clothing, a flashlight that can also be used to signal a rescue helicopter, a first aid kit, extra water, and food supplies. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The County of San Diego and the U.S. Marine Corps are teaming up to bring smiles to children's faces this holiday season. You can help by donating a new, unwrapped toy to their annual Toys for Tots drive. Collection boxes are out through December 17th at four county airports, including Gillespie Field in El Cajon and the Ramona Airport here in East County. The toys that are donated are distributed each year to less fortunate children in our county communities. As they have done in previous years, Marines will hold a special collection in person and in full uniform from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, December 10th at the Ramona Airport. Donations can include new unwrapped toys, bikes, games, dolls, stuffed animals, or other items to delight youngsters in need. Pilots can also fly in their donations to the airports. No reindeer or sleigh necessary to brighten up a child's holiday season. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This week marks the anniversary of Pearl Harbor Day, and so we thought it would be an appropriate time to replay an interview we did a couple of years ago with Ken Hansen, who was there as a young man the day Pearl Harbor was bombed by the Japanese. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine and KNSJ. Today, I'm very honored to have as my guest Ken Hansen, my next-door neighbor. All week, we've been talking with staff and friends and people across East County about their most interesting holiday recollections, and so today, Ken is going to share one of his. But first, a little bit of background. Ken, you were just a young man when your family moved to Hawaii in 1937. I understand that was a very auspicious day.
That is correct. We sailed on the old Malolo from Los Angeles to San Francisco and then to Hawaii. And the day that we sailed from San Francisco was the day that Amelia Earhart went down.
My goodness.
And which became the headline news for days and weeks.
Around the world.
So that was, in a sense, made that day very special that I remember sailing for Hawaii to live. And I was very excited about the whole thing. Also, we sailed under the Golden Gate Bridge, which just yep. weeks after it had opened.
Ah, San Francisco.
That, too, was very exciting as I think back.
Now, fast forward a couple of years to December 7th, 1941. You were living in Honolulu that holiday season, or just before the Christmas season, when Pearl Harbor was bombed. What was the first inkling you had that something was very wrong?
I lived in Honolulu at the time. I was home with my father and a university student who lived with us.
And you were how old?
I was 13 in eighth grade, and we could hear noises off in the distance, rumblings. But there had been a lot of preliminary building up of defense-type noises prior to this day as the possibility of war had escalated. So nothing much was made of these sounds except that one of us said, that must be Punch Bowl erupting.
The volcano.
Punch Bowl is an extinct volcano in Honolulu, which is now a national cemetery of renown.
But at that time,
it was a place where we went for picnics. Well, obviously, Punch Bowl wasn't erupting, and we had a frantic telephone call from my aunt, mm-hmm. who lived in a home on the beach beside Diamond Head, and she had seen with her own eyes a Japanese plane go by very low, so that she actually had eye contact, she thought, with the pilot.
Wow.
And she frantically called us and said that we are being attacked and don't move, like everybody else was saying.
Now, you were taking a typing class in school at the time, and I understand that that very night you sat down at home with your typewriter and you typed up a memoir. I can't
believe that I did it, but yes, I was taking typing. And, of course, had just been to class, the last class on Friday.
Would you be willing to read it to us?
Sure. I'll read part of it, and we can talk about part of it, too.
And you've told me this was one of the most memorable days in your life?
This was indeed a memorable day in that things stand out so clearly, even now, just as the other day in my life, my wedding day, stands out with great detail. I called this Memoirs of a Bombay Day. That was my 13-year-old sense of humor. We were having breakfast, as usual, on Sunday morning, Nabucco, the university student at our house, and I, when we heard a faint rumbling in the distance. Nabucco went to the door and said to me, Punch Bowl must be erupting. Well, we just laughed and forgot about that. And that was around 7:45 or 8 o'clock, and about a quarter to nine, I was getting ready to go to Sunday school, which I was supposed to do, when my aunt called frantically from where she lived off of Diamond Head on the beach and said, turn the radio on quickly, that Waianae was under fire. Waianae was one of the areas that was hit, but only one of many. We turned it on right away and were just in time to hear that Oahu was under attack, that we should stay calm, go at once to our houses, stay put, and keep the radio on all time. My father heard this, I'm ad-libbing now, and he found this very hard to believe, as did many people in the islands, that something actually bad was happening. They wanted to assume that this was practice.
Sure.
And it wasn't real, but it was real.
It had to be terrifying for you.
I wasn't terrified. This was a sense of thrill and excitement and fear all mixed up in a 13-year-old's mind. My mother was away at the time that this was happening.
Back to the memoir now.
Yes. When my daddy just laughed and said it was all practice or something like that, not to worry about it, she called, again frantically like my aunt, and said what she was seeing. She happened to be working with a group of university students at an area called Aiea Heights, which overlooks Pearl Harbor. So she sat there and was seeing what was happening. And she, too, said, don't move, I'll get home with the car as soon as I can. She had three students that she had to take home first. Announcements kept coming over the wire saying for no one to go out on the streets and for everyone to get off and stay off them. Daddy still laughed and said that since Sunday school was not very far away, that I might as well go. I refused. Meanwhile, we could see puffs of smoke coming up over the hills and hear what sounded like shooting and so forth. I begged to stay home. Then Mother got home, and she was able to describe precisely what she had been seeing. But I must say that even then, my father had trouble believing it. When he saw it in print, the first newspapers came out a little later in the morning through the neighborhoods, extra, extra, and he could see it. He gave in.
Your parents were very involved in this whole thing. Your mother, I understand, had a very close call herself.
She had to drive home, and there were several areas where anti-aircraft fire had come from Pearl Harbor into Honolulu. There was no actual bombing of Honolulu, but there were places where fires were started, and she could have been hit by an anti-aircraft.
It was shrapnel.
Shrapnel, yeah, whatever. Anyway, she got home safely, delivered her students, and all was well.
Your father worked at the university.
Yes. My dad worked for the Agricultural Extension Service at the University of Hawaii. And with his expertise, he and others in his office were immediately taken by the government. First of all, military rule took over immediately that day. Military rule was called. And he and others were called to the capital, downtown. They cleared the throne room of the thrones and put in desks immediately. So the very next day, Monday, he was at a desk down there helping to assess the food situation for Oahu and the other islands, finding out how much was available and where it was available and how it was going to be distributed.
I understand that your father also wrote a memoir, Ken, of that time. Could you read a little bit of what he wrote?
He did, with considerable detail, and we are certainly grateful to him for having sat down and done that in the midst of a terribly busy time. He was working at the Extension Service in food distribution and production, and the director already had a job on the Territorial Food Committee, and they went to work even Sunday morning, and by Monday my father was in his office at the Capitol. Inventories of food and feed were made instantly. I'm reading from his own writing. The grocery stores were crowded and then ordered closed Tuesday for inventory. Note that the situation is different here than on the mainland. 65% of our food, and again I'm quoting, is imported. And if no ships come in, we eat sparingly. Wednesday, when the stores were opened and normal requirements were sold, but the shelves were low. The big wholesalers hold the keys, which appear to be good. There are relatively few wholesalers in town, and inventories were easily made. One small job I had to do was get information from 15 dealers of food by Monday morning between 11 and 11:45. The Central Committee met at Iolani Palace by noon. We are now standing by for more. This was written the day after.
Yeah, and your father's name was?
Kenneth Hansen.
Just like yours, so Kenneth Hansen.
Yep.
The second. Very good. Thank you for sharing that. So what was that first night like? Here you're at home, the island's just been bombed.
The first night was certainly memorable for an excitable 13-year-old.
You've written about it, I see.
Our house was situated on a hill, and we normally had a nice view with many lights to be seen. Of course, this was total blackout then, and we sat and peered out the windows at total blackness. And the big thing was not knowing, were they coming back? Were they coming back that night? Were they going to land the next day on the beaches? Were they coming to get us? What was going to happen?
We
did not know. Manoa Valley, where I lived, was usually bright with lights, and it was gray as the mountains behind it. Every so often we could see a blue light from a car, but they did not last long. About 8:15 we managed to find our beds and pile in them. I think all of us were glad to do so.
Now, you were active in the Boy Scouts at the time, and I understand that they helped with some of the things that needed to be done.
Yeah, at the time I was in Troop 1 of Honolulu, and the very next day, by afternoon, they had gotten hold of us and corralled us, and we met at a school, and we were trucked downtown Honolulu, where we were assigned to the city hall, well, other places too, but I was at the city hall. We helped with sandbagging.
Sandbagging to protect against shrapnel.
Building up against the buildings, yes. We were supposed to be messengers and take messages from one downtown building to another, which didn't particularly happen. But again, looking up to the sky and hearing or seeing a plane made us wonder if they were coming back. Nobody knew who was coming or when. So that was part of the excitement and fear of the day. It was a mixture of excitement and fear.
Now, you also volunteered at a hospital with the Scouts.
Well, with the Scouts, we were out of school for 2 months or more.
No school for 2 months.
And most of the time we were busy, thanks to the Scouts, because we were assigned to such jobs as handing out gas masks at schools, helping with draft physicals because there was major drafting going on at the time, and working at a hospital, carrying boxes and doing whatever needed doing. Every place was a beehive of activity, and it was good. It kept us off the streets and doing something that was helpful.
There you go.
Yes, indeed.
Now, when Christmas came along, it was very different that year. Obviously, no holiday lights. The blackout was still
effect. Total blackout. Christmas came along 2.5 weeks later.
Did you have a Christmas tree?
And no Christmas trees. A freighter carrying evergreens from the state of Washington was torpedoed somewhere between Washington and Honolulu, and that would have been most of the trees that people would have bought.
Mm-hmm.
So
what
down,
did you do?
Down they went. So we had to make do. We pulled up banana leaves and other things from the yard or the yard next door, and we got out the ribbons and the ornaments and put them on. Of course, no lights, because at that time we at night had only a storeroom with no windows to sit in if we wanted to be up and at them.
Wow.
Eventually, the kitchen was blacked off with denim and tape and stuff so we could sit in the kitchen. But it's pretty hot and humid in Hawaii, and it wasn't...
Yes, it is.
It wasn't pleasant sitting in a room all evening. So.
No, you're used to opening the windows and enjoying those ocean
views.
Yeah,
so then it had to be dark.
Now, for holiday dinner, was that affected?
I can't remember our holiday dinner. We were with my uncle and aunt and family. Mm-hmm. And
you've told me that traditionally in your family, your grandfather owned a turkey ranch someplace.
Yeah, we expected a turkey from California since my grandfather owned a turkey ranch and usually had a turkey or two fattened up especially for us for the holidays.
But not that year?
No, it may have been that year. We had it for Thanksgiving. I just don't remember. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it probably went down on another ship.
Oh, my goodness. So this went on for 4 years. You stayed in the islands throughout the war, I understand.
Yes, yes. We stayed until it was time for me to go away to college. An amazing time to have lived there. In many ways, we were probably like normal teenagers, but our schooling was disrupted because the armed forces took over many of the schools. My particular school, called an intermediate school, was divided in three parts, and we were left with the Quonset hut-type part of the school, and the main part was taken over by the Army, and we had classes only half a day, and other parts of our school had to go to elementary schools that were available for other half days. So we were divided up into actually three parts and scattered around the city. And then when it came time for high school, 10th grade, and I was transferred to Punahou School, the Army had the school, and we were given and using a building at the University of Hawaii. Mm. The School of Education was our school until August of 1945, and the war was over, and the Army immediately gave the school back, and there was a frantic rush to put it back in order.
Now, you went on later in life to become a very successful doctor. Did those early days working in that hospital and seeing all the injuries and the suffering that you must have seen as a young man, did that influence your decision to want to help people by becoming a physician?
I'm pretty sure it did. I think really of those first days of the war when I got to be in the hospital and going all over and carrying things and having a feel for it. And then 2 years later, along around 10th grade, I had a summer job at the hospital where I really saw things going on and had a good feel for it and felt like I liked it. I didn't mind the sights and so forth and so on, working with patients, carrying dishes. Well, that must have been an influence as I look back, yes.
So often this time of year we hear the term peace on earth, and I think a lot of us probably don't stop to reflect on how much we take that for granted until you've been through something like the bombing of Pearl Harbor and have gone on to tell about that.
Yes, peace on earth escaped us that year, 1941, and through the awful years of the Second World War. And during this time, I, of course, along with my schoolmates, matured and learned something about the world, and by the time the war was over, we knew an awful lot more than we did as eighth graders when it all started.
I can imagine. Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show here on KNSJ.
It is a pleasure to be here and think about it and talk about it.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, A.K. Jules, Kevin McLeod, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.